I had two versions of this talk. I mean, one of them was the one I was going to give, and it differed from this one in that it had a list of names of my collaborators. But then my computer turned out to be incompatible with the system here, and I used a slightly different version, which removed, in which the names of my collaborators were not present, which, of course, has an advantage of making it look like I did it all myself. But the names that were here were Liberty, Tigert, Muddleson, and Wolf, I believe. Have I missed anyone? No, okay, maybe not.
I'm okay with that list.
Okay. So, and the title of my talk is Accurate Randomized Algorithms of Numerical Analysis. We really are familiar, if you will, with two classes of randomized algorithms. One of them, think of them as classical Monte Carlo methods. And think of it, you know, the first page in every probability theory textbook, you want to determine the area of a region. All you can do is, given a point, you can determine whether it's inside or outside. So you put the region in a square and start bombarding it with points. So then you simply take the ratio of the number of points inside to the number of points outside, and you get yourself an estimate of the area. Now, in computer science, there is a different kind of randomized scheme. A usual example is Quicksort. You have a bunch of points, numbers. Think of them as long numbers. And you want to sort them. Well, you take and put a point right in between, split it in two, put all elements that are less than this value to the left and the rest to the right. Then, of course, you repeat the same thing. And you keep doing it until you have one element in every subinterval. And it is the CPU time estimate is n log n, and it works just fine, except sometimes the points are like this. So when you try to do the normal bisection, you do it forever, especially if the key is long. So the trivial fix is to split at a random point. Now, the interesting thing is that everything works very well. A single screw-up costs you very little. Suppose you put it in the wrong place. You just didn't sort anything. Next time will be OK. And it is extremely insensitive to the quality of your random number generator. The numbers don't have to be random. They don't have to be even particularly independent. It's just that the enemy shouldn't know what they are. Because, you know, otherwise, a malicious user can have fun. Now, on the other hand, if you look at the Monte Carlo techniques, here, suppose you throw a million points, and one of them went astray. You just got yourself an error in the 6 digits, and nothing will fix it. Which means that it is an infinitely somewhat low accuracy technique. You know, because of central limit theorem, the error behavior is 1 over square root of n, where n is the number of experiments. And, you can try to improve it a bit, but on the whole, that's what it tries to be. And in many areas of life, Monte Carlo type techniques are an approach of last resort because people do not like to have square root of n in the denominator. I certainly don't. So, randomized discrete algorithms of discrete applied mathematics are very popular for the reason I just described. The randomized algorithms of numerical analysis are considerably less so. And yet, when we do randomized algorithms, when we look at classical computer science, if you will, we discover that many problems that are essentially intractable when handled deterministically die with a whimper when handled with fairly simple randomized algorithms. So it looks, at least philosophically, appealing to say, okay, let's construct some algorithms of numerical analysis that would hopefully solve some non-trivial problems, and behave like numerical like non-numerical algorithms of discrete mathematics, in the sense that A, they are accurate, B, they forgive mistakes, and C, they don't depend too critically on the quality of random numbers. Well, we actually, at the present time, there are at least two classes of such algorithms I'm aware of. And one of them is the kind I'm going to talk about, that is compression flow rank matrices. And the other one is what is known as orthogonal pursuits. So, and I am going to be talking, as I said, about the randomized algorithms for the compression of flow rank matrices. Well, everybody knows about compression of matrices. You have a matrix of limited rank, you whack it with a QR or an SVD algorithm, and you get yourself a much compressed object. In some very strong sense, it occurs every time we solve a continuous problem in the computer, because a computer, as we all know, is a finite device, or most of us know. Well, in numerical linear algebra, of course, Google, FMMs, and anything else, just about anything, really, uses compression of matrices, either explicitly or otherwise. So it is, in any case, essential for legitimate problems. The gold-plated tool, of course, in the family is the SVD, which represents our matrix, the precision epsilon, as a product of orthogonal matrix, diagonal, orthogonal. Of course, these are not orthogonal matrices. They just have columns or rows, whatever, orthogonal, orthonormal, because they're not square. Otherwise, if they're square, then what are we doing? We're not compressing anything. Now, it is clearly optimal. You cannot do better than this in terms of dimensionality. But a bit expensive. So sometimes, often, QR is used instead, where Q is orthogonal matrix and R is triangular matrix. Or is it the other way around? So it's cheaper than SVD, but by a finite factor, really. The factor is not enormous, so the cost is still M and K, where M and N are dimensionalities of the matrix, and K is the rank. There are other classical decompositions, and any one of you can invent a non-classical one if you want to. But I'm going to be talking about a recently introduced tool known as skeletonization. It has the following structure. It looks sort of like SVD, except instead of diagonal matrix here, we have a K by K submatrix of A. So we use the matrix A itself. The guy on the left basically is M by K matrix. That is not orthogonal anymore. It couldn't be orthogonal. But it is well conditioned. It contains an identity as a K by K identity as a submatrix. And the same is true about the expanded matrix here. It is about as accurate as SVD. As QR, it is it has obvious advantages, because the only way, in some sense, A, is accessed is through the submatrix. And it deserves, I believe, a short discussion on its own. It's really a theorem from linear algebra, a trivial one. It basically says that given a matrix A, mapping Rm to Rn, of numerical rank k, the precision epsilon rank k, there exists a k-dimensional coordinate subspace in Cm, such that the matrix can be represented simply as a restriction on the subspace, plus a sort of interpolating matrix, which is, again, doesn't have large eigenvalues, doesn't have large elements. And it clearly should have an identity submatrix, k by k, because on itself it is, some elements are just mapped by themselves. That's where they live. So basically this diagram is commutative to precision epsilon, and epsilon is the approximation part of the thing. There is an alternative explanation, an alternative representation. You identify a k by k, k-dimensional coordinate subspace in Cn and reverse the diagram. So basically, again, you don't, you restrict A, it should be AKK, no, it's AK, sorry. You map the thing, instead of mapping it into whole CN, you map it into subspace and then interpolate from the subspace to the rest of CN. And again, the interpolating matrix is well conditioned. Finally, you can combine the two and obtain such a pretty diagram where both CN and CM, each of them has its own k-dimensional subspace, and you interpolate down, map, interpolate up. And again, such a diagram is commutative to precision epsilon, and each eval and expand of eval matrix eval and expand contain a k by k identity submatrix. Now, clearly, this is the statement that the rank is small, the condition number is low, is the only interesting statement here. Otherwise, everything I'm saying, talking about would be a pure tautology. But the fact that you can choose matrices expand and eval that don't have big elements, in fact, all elements can be less than one, is a substantive statement. Now, when I began to draw commutative diagrams, I suddenly stopped and looked at myself in the mirror. Here I am, you know, applied mathematician, do reasonable things, computing the computer. Why would I look at commutative diagrams? I mean, it's insane. Then I remember that my daddy was a topologist.
And as you mentioned, his advisor was Komogoro.
Not mine, my father's.
Yes.
But never mind, but it's not the point. The point is that that's where the poison came from. Now, I have an interpretation which is in some sense superfluous, but it illustrates what I was telling you about. Suppose we have M charges and N targets. And we want to represent, and we have charges and we want to evaluate the potential. What I told you is that you can choose a subset of K charges and represent the potential of all those M charges as a linear combination of these K charges to precision epsilon, and the mapping, and there is a linear mapping for the rest, taking the rest of charges and converting them into these ghost charges that will represent the potential of the whole mass. There is a dual representation, interpretation. You take these M charges, evaluate it at K properly chosen points, and interpolate from these points the potential onto the rest of them. Now, this way, I find it easier to think about than the purely linear algebraic language, but it is slightly deceptive because it has nothing to do with charges. The fact is linear algebra. It's just, you know, I like to think about charges. There is a trivial algorithm. The algorithm is you take the biggest column and you orthogonalize the rest of them. You choose the next biggest column, orthogonalize the rest of them.
What does biggest mean here?
Your favorite norm. L2, fine, I mean, you name it. It's not a saying, you know, okay, so eventually, of course, if your rank, the rank of your matrix to precision K, to precision epsilon is K, after you chose such K columns, the rest is less than epsilon, hopefully, and you can stop. Now, you simply keep track of which columns you chose, and this is your skeleton. Simple. It's unstable. It's unstable because the Gram-Schmidt is unstable, the way I described it. What you do is so-called double Gram-Schmidt. Do not trust textbooks. A normal linear algebra textbook will tell you that there is Gram-Schmidt and there is modified Gram-Schmidt. And one of them is stable and the other is unstable or something. Baloney. They are both unstable, and the difference in stability is trivial. If you look, what's his name? I think, is it Bjork, yeah? Who has it? If you want to see a correct description of the environment, there is a book by Bjork, you know, it's in Dalkvist and Bjork, where he explains how things really work. It's one of the most devastating things about the world that I know of. Because any one of those clowns who wrote the textbook, had he run it, would know it doesn't work. I mean, I'm trembling. Now, there is a slight infinitesimal additional issue. Even when you use Gramsci, Bell Gramsci, or any other deterministic technique of this type, there are counterexamples. They never occur. You don't need to worry about them, but they exist. And then there is a paper by Guy d'Anzestad where they construct algorithms to which it cannot happen. That always work. Nobody uses them. No, simply because it's not worth it. Things work. But people use them. And the cost of the whole exercise is obviously NMK. Because you have to use K columns that are bases to orthogonalize the rest of it to them. Now, once you have found the skeletons, determining a vowel and expand matrices is ridiculously simple. You have these key columns, and you simply represent the rest of them, the linear combinations of these K columns in the discourse sense. We know it will work because the rank is K. We're done. The only slight, and the same, of course, you can do with rows. The only slightly non-trivial observation is this. You only need to do this on the upper, for example, when you do it with columns, you only need to do it in the upper band. You do it in the upper band, but the rank of the whole thing is K. So it guarantees that if you construct a linear combination of these K columns representing this column here, the same linear combination will represent them here. It's simply the linear dependence aspect of this integration. So now, but that's important. Because it does not cost m and k. It costs m plus n times k squared. So the estimate, if your rank is low, is very much better. Well, once you have eval and expand, then containing the SVD or anything else is a and it again costs nm n plus m k squared. So once you have an interpolated decomposition, obtaining any standard decomposition like SVD is order n plus m k squared operations, and everybody is singing and dancing. Now I just told you something slightly non-trivial. What I told you is this: that the all existing algorithms use MMK operations to construct any of the classical decompositions. If someone gave me 2K integer numbers, just the selection of the skeleton for rows and the skeleton for columns, then I or anybody else can construct the rest of SVD in order N plus MK squared operations. So in order to get this reduction in complexity, and that's a complexity result, you only need to obtain the skeleton rows and columns. So it is not really an interpolation question. It's something like you just need to identify the skeleton, right? If you identified it somehow, we know what to do next. Now, identifying an object would seem like a proper job for a randomized algorithm. It's sort of almost computer science, right? And of course, as a Russian, I have to make a very strong disclaimer. I much prefer making skeletons to finding them. what is wanted is a scheme that would apply A to a small collection of vectors, perform some calculation that is not expensive, too expensive, perhaps when A is sparse, because then applying matrices to vectors is cheaper. And somehow would produce a skeleton of A. We don't need anything else, just 2K numbers. It has to be randomized, obviously. And it is a subject of many prior attempts, under different names usually, And how every one of us cares about someone taking a big matrix, choosing a subset of columns, and you name it. Well, it cannot work in the sense we're interested in. Because a single large element, in a single column you missed, will screw up your calculation. So we have to, one way or another, access every element, if not physically, then in spirit, because, for example, maybe you have a fast algorithm, so you don't actually touch the element, but it is included in the scheme. So there is an obvious modification of the algorithm. You take A and apply it to a collection of random vectors. The rank of A is K. So we choose the collection of random vectors of size k plus a bit, k plus p. Now think about it. In exact arithmetic, k is always enough, right? What is the chance that the determinant will be exactly zero? But of course, you will encounter some condition numbers, because the vectors will try to line up, or might try to line up. So we clearly need more than k random vectors. So how big should p be so that the chance of them lining up to any uncomfortable degree would be small? Well, the answer is to me was shocking. And I have to confess that we discovered it in purely experimental ways first. It turns out the trivial values of P lead to algorithms that recover the whole thing with essentially 100% reliability. For a fixed epsilon, the probability of losing that much accuracy decays faster as a function of p than 1 over any polynomial, which is fast. The scheme costs kq plus nm k squared, n plus m k squared, where q is the cost of applying the matrix to a vector to obtain the whole scale transition. And it is not a theoretical result in the sense that the actual CPU times are quite reasonable.
Question?
Yes, sir.
So I think I must be missing something. If you want to protect yourself against an adversary who can hide energy in one really large element, then how can you ever avoid being order nm? Because don't you have to read the whole matrix?
I'm assuming, in many situations, as you know, we have either, say, a sparse matrix.
No, or if you tell me 1% of the entries are sparse, then it's still 1%.
No. You're laughing at the old man. It's not nice.
No, I'm not.
I'm taking a vector and applying a matrix to it. In that sense, every element of the matrix is touched, independently of how you apply the matrix. I have a vector without zero elements. Every element of the matrix is touched. If I have k plus p, non-zero element vectors, then every element of the matrix is touched k plus p times. That's all.
So when you say the scheme costs this much,
q is the cost of
multiplying. Q is the cost of multiplying by
matrix by that,
which might be n.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we'll deal with that too. But for now. For example, if p is 20, then the probability of losing 10 to minus 17 accuracy is less. The probability of losing, producing an error in the 17th digit is less than 1 minus 10 to 17, to the minus 17. Is great. Is less than 10 to minus 17. Which is a devastating statement. It must grow
up. It's not an error in the 17th digit. It's an error of the magnitude on the right hand side of it.
Yeah. At any rate, the probability of if you're doing 17-digit calculations, then the probability of getting, doing this, and seeing any loss of accuracy is less then 10 to minus 17, as soon as you got yourself air, D equals 20, an independent of M. And K. I'm doing such a strange example because the actual estimates look ugly. They contain very strange Bessel functions and whatnot. Now let me describe this scheme to you. You take a bunch, a K plus P, random vectors, normal, and you apply A to them. Now you have K vector, K plus P vectors in Rm. Lengths, vectors of length. K plus, of depth, legs M, and K plus P of them. Now you can scalarize this matrix. Use Gram-Schmidt over time. And you get yourself a row skeleton of A. It's very simple. Instead of skeletonizing the whole A, you whack A against K plus P random vectors, get a much compressed vector matrix, and skeletonize that. Then, of course, now you have the skeletonized matrix, right? Now it's K, where K is the skeleton, by M N matrix. Skeletonize that in the other direction, and you've got yourself a column skeleton. Now you have a complete skeleton of A. It's an obvious thing to do. Anybody could think about it, indeed. The only interesting thing is that you actually, the skeletons you choose are just as good as the ones you would get from A itself, provided that P is greater than 20.
Question?
Yes, sir.
Do you need to know K to be able to use this
algorithm? I probably have an answer on the next page. No. Okay, what you do is what I do is I set K to 20, no, to 40, and we try it. If it does, then I get a certain rank. If my rank is greater than 20, the difference is less than 20, I jack it up to 40, and I continue. You will never lose a factor of 2 this way. It's a tautological thing to do. So now then, of course, we construct a valent expand, and we observe that they are valid within the whole matrix for the reason I described. And everybody is singing and dancing. There is a massive non-originality disagreement. It is not the first time this algorithm has been proposed or used. I named two papers here. It is not at all a claim that they are the only ones are the first. It's an obvious algorithm. The only thing I think I'm claiming is that it is an accurate algorithm. Now, I will give a very brief outline, of course. And it relies on two facts. One of them is that if given an arbitrary matrix Mn, Mn R and Rn, and IID matrix G, and by plus P, by K plus P, the product IG has K singular vector values that are not too different from the corresponding singular values of A. That's what I will show. And the principal technical tool is trivial. If you apply an orthogonal matrix to a bunch of random, normal IID vectors, they don't change. I mean, they change, but in a very immaterial way. They stay. The distributions don't change. So let me, the first observation. So we have a matrix A, and we have our matrix G, which is K. N by K plus P, and we're constructing the product. Well, as everybody else, we start with looking at the singular value decomposition of N, A. Now, clearly, this is diagonal. These columns are, rows are orthonormal of this, and columns are orthonormal on U. Well, U can be ignored, obviously. It doesn't do anything. It's an orthogonal matrix. So we throw out, now we're looking at D multiplied by V. But then, of course, D, V, G. But then, of course, what happens when we take G and apply V to it? We get, it doesn't change, it stays a collection of independently distributed ta-ta-ta-ta-ta numbers. So now we have reduced the situation to something slightly different. Now G is essentially the same, and instead of A, we have D. It's a diagonal matrix with eigenvalues on the diagonal. And what we really need to show is that if we take that the first thing K, singular vectors of the product, singular values of the product, will not differ too much from singular values from lambda 1 and so on. But that's easy. Let me go back. So what we really are going to do is we're going to take this product. And we're going to take its first k by k, k by k plus m, right? This product will be k by k plus m submatrix. And we estimate the singular values of the submatrix. And we'll discover that they're pretty close to lambda 1, lambda 2, and lambda k. And the proof is absolutely childishly simple. We arrange it in this form, and we use Jacobi rotations to reduce this matrix to a bidiagonal form. Now, it is important that it is lower bidiagonal form, because k, you will remember, is less than k plus p. So what we do is this. We rotate these two columns to kill this element, rotate these two columns to kill this element, and so on, and we do the same here. If you look at it carefully, then of course, so this column and this row are zero. Then we rotate these two elements and these two elements and so on, and we kill the second column and the second column and the second row, and we keep going. All we do, the interesting thing is this, that since the matrix elements are independent of each other, imagine that we are rotating these two rows in order to kill this element. Then we do not change, for all practical purposes, all the other elements in these two rows. We are applying an orthogonal matrix to 2x2 matrix, the pair of vectors that are normal and the same. What is it? IID. So the whole thing continues. The subsequent stages of the procedure continue without any interruption. They don't change. So now we are looking at, and of course we have not changed the singular values. Now we have this situation. And this bidiagonal matrix alphas, this alpha, is of the order square root of k plus p, because that's what we just added up. And beta is square root of k. This is square root of k plus p minus 1, and beta is k minus 1, and so on. So the matrix is diagonally dominant. And how? Then, of course, we use Gershgorin theorem, Gershgorin theorem, another Russian. Actually, he was French, but never mind. Gershgorin theorem, it says that eigenvalues of a matrix or singular values, they are located inside circles, the center of the circle is a diagonal element, it's complicated. But once you go through the calculation and substitute things, you get exactly. You get an ugly estimate that you can find in our papers. Now, slightly stronger estimates are available directly from a paper by Dangara Chen about specifically the subject. They measure areas on the SON in order to make these estimates. But their estimate is about twice better than ours, literally. Not twice the number of digits, twice. So now I'm going to demonstrate some numerical examples, just to And well, all of them were done in Bell Precision, 2.8 gigahertz Pentium. They were all done in Fujitsu with Fujitsu compiler. We calculated both SVD and interpolated decompositions. Large-scale linear algebra was done via simply double Gram-Schmidt. Not modified. The small-scale SVD was computed simply using SVD, Jacobi iterations, rotations. It's a wrong thing to use, but it doesn't matter. It's a small-scale calculation. And there was no attempt made to optimize codes for speed. So this is we're advocating Devil. P is equal to zero in this example. Well, you can and both are equal to 10. So we take a million by million matrix with such eigenvalues, singular values. We do the calculation. Basically, yeah, we lose a bit in accuracy. But at that, p equals zero. P equals zero, but it's slightly different. We simply reduce the accuracy. So when the accuracy is below the accuracy of the computer substantially, there is no loss of precision. Remember, the calculations are done in double precision. So 10 to minus 6 is way inside the. Here are, you take a 50,000 by 50,000. And the rank is 30. And then we play with the numbers of with P. Here, 0, 1, 2, 16. Now, you do get a slight improvement, right? In accuracy. But nothing dramatic. And here, finally, it is sort of simply advocating Devil. We said, again, L equals. Okay, there is a reason why we like p equals zero. Because when p is not equal to zero, on the whole, what you get is a sequence of perfect runs. You don't get any information. On the other hand, when p is equal to zero, we have an estimate of the error estimated, and you can run it a million times and check the estimate, which is what we did. You cannot, it's sort of a purely mechanical thing. Some observation. Numerical tests do not contradict the estimates. There is very little, we call this P oversampling. There is very little oversampling required. And normally, we also screwed around with the quality of the random number generator. It doesn't fit. If you have a number distributed on minus 1 to 1 instead of uniformly, instead of random, it just did such. There are, of course, technical details. Someone asked me about them. Determining the rank and so on. It's a coding exercise. And in exactly the twist that I was insisting on from the beginning, it sort of behaves more like a quicksort than like a Monte Carlo algorithm. Because, it's insensitive to distributions, etc. It always works, and so on. But of course, it does depend on a fast algorithm. Because otherwise, you remember, who said it? You said it. If the matrix is dense, then, and there is no fast algorithm associated with it, you get still M and K operations, and you die. Now, what do we do? What can we do if there is no fast algorithm? So we have a dense matrix, say. And we want to multiply it by a random matrix and by K plus P. And this damn thing is dense and does not support fast multiplication. What do you do? Well, this doesn't support fast multiplication. And we need to have a random matrix with independent values. But do they need to be very independent? Nah. I mean, think what we just did, right? All we need is one from our element, from our vectors, is to sample the space more or less uniformly. And if here sampling is half as dense as here, who cares? You will lose 1/8 of one digit, maybe. unless you already listed someone else. So what are you going to do is this. You observe that the whole thing can be interpreted as calculating the product of two matrices. One is n by m, the other is, or n by m, m, n, m by n, and the other is n by k plus p. So perhaps we can concoct a matrix that will be arguably a somewhat random matrix, but would support a fast algorithm. You know, if the mountain doesn't go to Muhammad, Muhammad can go to the mountain. Now, there are many such algorithms, actually. And we did not invent, well, we invented some and we didn't invent others. The three ones you find in the literature, not published by us, are based on basically taking a Fourier transform of all things, pre-multiplying it by something random, post-multiplying it by something random, and a few other things. Or instead of Fourier transform, we can take Walsh transform. And neither of them in our experiments is the best you can do. We have. But it's a technical matter. You just can't do it. So now, everything is exactly the same as before, except instead of multiplying A by vectors one after another, we multiply the adjoint of G by rows of A one after another. And you get yourself in the, you can have a very fast algorithm. It turns out that we can prove that it has to be mn log k operations. I'm not sure you cannot do MN, because we have methods that seem to work, but we don't have proofs for any estimate better than MN log K, which is not so bad. No. Log is a bounded function. And this is a bona fide complexity statement.
It's an upper end.
Yeah. I am not aware of any mechanism to show either that the algorithms that seem to work actually do work in less than that, or, I'm completely lost so far as any improvements on that are concerned. It's a bona fide complexity. The analysis becomes considerably more complicated. The simple-minded linear algebraic description I gave you does not work in this case because things are not sufficiently independent. But it works like a charm. We have algorithms, an algorithm that in this regime works indistinguishably from the one that requires major sector multiplications. It's exactly the same. And I cannot come near proving it. Now, this algorithm, this whole class of algorithms, is a subject of Mark Taggart's talk next Friday. And anybody who knows Mark knows that he's a guy not to be crossed. So I will get off the subject. Well, of course, the obvious comparison is with Lanczyk methods. In the absence, that's what we would use under such conditions, especially if you have a fast. Well, you can construct matrices for which Lanczyk method will behave roughly the same way. You simply have to space their eigenvalues more or less uniformly. And then Lanczyk will need an iteration per eigenvalue, we need an iteration per eigenvalue, and there is no particular trouble. Of course, once you have a few multiple eigenvalues, or eigenvalues that try to be multiple, Lanczyk dies painful and well-deserved death.
But hang on. It depends whether you want to converge to the right subspace or you also want to converge to
With obvious why?
Imagine you're trying to find the basis for a slightly non-circular ellipse.
Yes.
Which is embedded like a pancake in some larger space. Now, we're very quickly going to converge to the subspace which spans the that rank 2. But it might take me ages to line up with the axes of the ellipse. But if all I care about is spanning the right subspace, then it doesn't really matter, right?
There are too many regimes to discuss it in these terms. I mean, you can't come up with regimes which is true. I mean, the statement, so far as I can tell, I haven't proved cleanly, is that this thing always beats Lanczos. So, there are special cases where it doesn't really. You know. And of course, when the matrices are dense, the situation is completely different. Because Lanczos cannot do anything fast. It has to multiply. It generates a sequence of vectors. And you don't know the vector, the preceding vector before, the next vector before you are finished with the preceding one. So you, Lanczos is rarely used for dense matrices for that basic reason. Well, there are obvious applications of these things. I have my own, it so happens that I grew up, if you will, with applied mathematics, with numerical analysis. So I never used packages. I was implementing and testing algorithms as they were invented over the last 30 years. And in my library, SVDs of matrices of limited rank are done using this algorithm. And there is a new statement, if it's less than, I don't remember, 200 by 200, then I use direct double Gram-Schmidt. If it is greater than 200 by 200, I use this. I mean, there is no accuracy loss. And my belief is that that's how it will be. Because, you know, very often, you don't want to mess with the nature of your matrix. You want to take a matrix, stick it in your machine as a dense matrix, run it, see what the spectrum is. And of course, in this case, the fast version of this algorithm, as we call it, is you just don't need to. You know, generally the thinking is bad, right? So you don't want to think. So as I said, I described a class of randomized schemes for the compression of large Lorentz matrices. It has both a version that uses the fact that the matrix can be applied to a vector rapidly, and there is a version that deals with dense matrices. In the latter case, we have actually a complexity statement. It produces, practically speaking, exact results. It's entirely independent of the structure of the matrix except for the epsilon rank. It is competitor to Lanczos methods, or if you will, never mind. There are obvious spin-offs and related issues. Well, obviously complex version as opposed to real one is trivial. In fact, the codes I have at this time are complex. I simply never implemented the real version because I needed a complex one. There are ways to use it for the rank determination. There is a regression version of similar stuff that will be given or discussed in Sarlos's talk. When is it? A couple of days from now. There is no claim that we scooped him, by the way. It's just a related class of algorithms. Claim made or implied. There is, of course, the version for self-adjoint operators can be improved. I mean, you can gain some cookies from that. So now, philosophically speaking, okay, if you don't look carefully at this algorithm, it looks like it is a scheme that is randomized and does something from analysis, linear algebra. And it does it accurately. But when you look at it more carefully, you see that all it does is it detects a certain subset of the skeleton. So we are cheating, actually. We don't have a bona fide computational, if you will, algorithm. The computations are done by the same Gram-Schmidt or Jacobian or whatever it is. It is the detection of the skeleton that is done in a randomized manner. So perhaps it should be called computer science, I don't know. And by the way, there is another recent, relatively recent algorithm along these lines. There is this surprising fact about orthogonal pursuits, a randomized algorithm for detecting non-zero elements in a vector. And again, when you don't look at it carefully, it seems like it might be a numerical, a bona fide numerical algorithm based on randomization and doing highly non-trivial stuff. But when you look more carefully, again, it turns out that you're just detecting something. It's still quicksort, it's still that same old quicksort or whatever it is. Thank you very much.